From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Harvey Pekar has been called a schlump, a crank, an eternal pessimist. He's also been compared to Dostoevsky, Lenny Bruce, and Mark Twain. He is the creator of the autobiographical comic series, American Splendor, about his hangdog life and 30-plus years as a file clerk at a VA hospital, and more recently, about the making of the 2003 film American Splendor, based on those comics. Tonight on Point, a conversation with the downtrodden dark horse of American Splendor, Harvey Pekar. But first tonight, we begin in Washington, where White House officials predicted today that the federal budget deficit this year will hit a new record of $427 billion. And next month, President Bush is now expected to ask Congress for an additional $80 billion, mostly to fund the war in Iraq, bringing the total costs of that war to more than $200 billion by the end of the year. Joining me now is Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Mark, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So, big federal budget deficit overall, and the Iraq war not doing anything to help. There were much smaller estimates of how many billions of dollars that war was going to cost this year. Now it's $80 billion. What's pumping it up so high?
Well, what's pumping it up is the fact that the monthly costs of the war in Iraq aren't going down at all, nor are the number of U.S. troops in Iraq. Pentagon officials are expecting that at least through this year, they're going to have to maintain about the same level of U.S. troops in Iraq. And right now, the costs of the war are about $4.3 billion per month. So we had been hearing estimates of maybe $50 to $60 billion, but as we saw today, that's now $80 billion, and that's on top of a previously authorized $25 billion that Congress gave to the White House over the summer. So this year's supplemental request is over $100 billion, which is certainly far higher than anything we had expected a couple months ago.
And never mind a couple months. Take us back a couple of years to the way that the Iraq War and its anticipated costs were described even before the invasion.
That's right. Several senior administration officials made various projections about the war in Iraq. You might remember Larry Lindsey, who was the president the director of the president's National Economic Council,
right,
suggested that it would cost between $100 and $200 billion.
And he effectively got booted for saying that.
He was ridiculed for that comment and was booted. Now we're seeing that Lindsey's estimate was very low. Paul Wolfowitz, the deputy defense secretary, said that basically right when the war in Iraq began, said that Iraq would very soon be able to finance its own reconstruction because of the oil revenues. And as we've seen, that has not happened, and the U.S. is footing the bill for it.
So where does all this go? $100 billion this year for the war in Iraq, plus some for Afghanistan, a little bit tucked in there. I saw, I think, $5 billion for tsunami aid. But in the out years, I hate to think what that even means, but in 2006, 2007, are there any projections at this point, or have they stopped projecting?
Well, it's interesting, because the way that they've been paying for the war is not part of the regular Pentagon budget. So the Pentagon budget is going up, but then they keep dropping these massive supplementals every year that are not part of the main budgeting process. There really doesn't seem to be anyone saying the supplemental requests are going to be going down in future years because no one can say with any real certainty that the insurgency in Iraq is going to diminish or that the U.S. troop levels are going to diminish. So as long as those things are continuing, the war is going to be very expensive.
And that expense is not put in the main Pentagon budget. Tabulated into the $427 billion deficit estimate federally that the White House announced today, or is it even apart from that?
Well, the White House is trying to keep them separate, and that's why there was some discrepancy today about exactly how big the deficit was going to be. And another estimate, the Congressional Budget Office estimate, included war costs, which showed that the deficit would continue to skyrocket in years to come.
So if it were added, does that mean the federal deficit would be $500 billion instead of $427?
Yeah, it would be approaching that. And so that's why when you add in the war costs, the United States economic picture in future years does not look very rosy.
Now, you said that this is apart from the Pentagon budget, but I think I've read stories in recent weeks about the Pentagon looking to economize on other programs, other weapons, in order to take care of veterans. And I thought the war in Iraq, is there no way in which it's pinching other Pentagon operations fiscally?
It is, actually. And they're realizing that in order to get these massive supplementals approved, they cannot have the main Pentagon budget be spiraling each year. So they have had to scale back on various high-tech future weapons that the Pentagon wanted to buy, at least buy in large quantities. They're basically going to have to scale back their orders of these weapons, such as this Air Force fighter, the F-22. So, yes, the main budget is going to be not smaller than last year, but the rate of increase is going to go down when the president submits his budget next month.
And I think I saw just today headlines suggesting some consideration of veterans' benefits, saying that they may be too generous. I use that word advisedly, that the government may not be able to afford them.
That's right. And the veterans' benefits that the Pentagon has to pay for are getting expensive for the Pentagon, as are just general personnel costs. And that is, you're right, something that is squeezing the Pentagon as it tries to drop these enormous budgets that they've done since the September 11th attacks.
Mark Mazzetti, what's the mood around the Pentagon, around these fiscal issues? Are they concerned that other missions are going to be squeezed, or is it just, well, we've got to do what we've got to do, and it'll cost what it costs?
There is concern on the personnel front. No one gets too worked up, although some people kind of get worked up when you scale back the number of fighter jets. But really, the concern is that you're not going to be able to pay for, let's say, bonuses for the National Guard or new or if the Army were to increase its ranks to be able to pay for these soldiers. That's the personnel issues are the ones that worry people most, because in a volunteer Army, a lot of times you have to use economic incentives to keep troops in the ranks. Hmm. So that is the mood on these issues. No one will tell you honestly that they were expecting these massive supplemental requests 2 years ago when they envisioned this war in Iraq. I mean, they didn't envision that there was going to be an insurgency 2 years on. So, everyone is trying to rewrite the rules as they go along here.
Well, $100 billion this year for Iraq and more down the road. Mark Mazzetti, thanks for being with us tonight.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Mazzetti, Pentagon reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with us from Washington. For more than 30 years, cranky comic book creator Harvey Pekar was mainly a file clerk at a VA hospital in Cleveland, and it shows. He scowls, he's often grumpy, he's constantly worried about money. In the 1970s, he began writing about his unvarnished life in the slow lane. With the help of some of the country's top underground illustrators, Pekar's dark musings became a cult comic series called American Splendor. In 2003, he became the subject of the film American Splendor, based on his comic series. Paul Giamatti, currently starring in Sideways, played the downtrodden file clerk. But Harvey Pekar is there on screen as well. Here, he introduces himself in the film.
This guy here, he's our man, all grown up and going nowhere. Although he's a pretty scholarly cat, he never got much of a formal education. For the most part, he's lived in neighborhoods, held jobs, and is now knee-deep into a disastrous second marriage. So if you're the kind of person looking for romance or escapism or some fantasy figure to save the day, guess what? You got the wrong movie.
American Splendor won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival and the International Critics Prize at Cannes. It was nominated for an Oscar. But fame hasn't mellowed Pekar. He's as worried as ever about where he'll get his next paycheck. Tonight on Point, Harvey Pekar's American Life. You can join our conversation. Are you an American Splendor fan, a Harvey Pekar fan from the movie or the comics? Do you see or hear yourself in the everyday woes of Harvey Pekar? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cleveland, Ohio, is the creator of the autobiographical comic series American Splendor, the subject of the 2003 movie American Splendor. He has two books out, American Splendor, Our Movie Year, and just out today, Best of American Splendor. Good evening and welcome, Harvey Pekar.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much for being with us. So you're the
God
blue.
God bless you.
And God bless you, my friend. What is it? Variety says you're the blue collar Mark Twain.
Well, they can say that.
Is that what you set out to be?
Well, Twain has indirectly influenced me. I like a lot of things about his writing. I think he was the first, or maybe really the first guy to write you know, outstanding literature in American English. I don't know if I was setting out to be the next Mark Twain or anything like that, but he's a good man, good writer.
Harvey Pekar, take us back to the 1970s, where you were, at least as portrayed in the movies and in your comics, laboring away down in these gloomy halls, filing for a VA hospital. What was it that got you started writing down your very mundane, even depressing daily life sometimes? What was it that got you thinking about writing that down, got you thinking about having that illustrated?
Well, for one thing, at that time I was a jazz critic, you know, and I've also written some literary criticism.
Who were you doing the criticism for, Harvey? What, for a newspaper or a magazine?
In 1959, I started with a nationally distributed publication called the Jazz Review,
mm-hmm.
That was edited by Martin Williams and Nat Henoff. It's a very fine the best one I ever wrote for. I wrote for Downbeat. I wrote for Metronome. I wrote for Coda in Canada. I wrote for the Jazz Journal and Jazz Monthly in England.
So you weren't just filing that stuff at the VA hospital. You were thinking about the world of art.
Yeah, I was into it. And, in 1962, though, a few years after I started writing this criticism, I met Robert Crumb in Cleveland. Crumb had come to Cleveland to live from Philadelphia.
The great cartoonist Fritz the Cat and a whole slew of things since. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And I saw some of his stuff. He lived about a block and a half away from me. And I had been familiar with comics when I was a little kid. I used to read them, but I got sick of them because I thought they were just all, you know, just about all kids stuff. And when I saw Crumb's work, I saw that they could appeal to adults and that they had great potential that hadn't been tapped. And I started theorizing about, you know, maybe, you know, doing comics about areas that hadn't been touched on, you know, like in my case, what did I know about? I knew about just slogging it out on a, you know, on a 40-hour-a-week basis. And I thought that life was an interesting life. I thought that you ran into a lot of dramatic situations and challenges and you had a lot of heartbreak, and you had a lot of, you know, you had a lot of good times. There's humor in the life. And I decided I'd try and write about that. And finally, in 1972, I wrote a bunch of stories in storyboard form, and I showed them to Crumb, who was visiting me.
Yeah.
And he... I said, what do you think, man? You think these are okay, you know? Think they're viable? And he says, yeah, you know, like, I'd like to take some of these home and illustrate them. So I said, oh, man, go ahead, you know?
Sure.
And he did. And he got my stuff published. And, you know, hey, that was a great way to start, you know.
Not too bad to start with our Crumb as your illustrator. What a great coincidence to know him, to have him as a friend.
Yeah, well, you know, I've had some good luck. I mean, maybe I'm a curmudgeon, but I'll admit I've had some pretty good luck. And among the pieces of good luck I've had is knowing Robert Crumb, from way back, from before anybody had ever heard of him, He's turned out to be a wonderful friend.
Harvey Pekar, stand by. We've got to take a short break. There's a lot more we want to hear. We're talking tonight with Harvey Pekar, the gloom and doom creator and protagonist of the autobiographical comic book series American Splendor, source of the 2003 movie starring Paul Giamatti that won top prizes at Cannes and Sundance. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you an American Splendor fan from the movie or the comics? And do you see or hear yourself in the everyday woes of Harvey Pekar? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Harvey Pekar, the gloom and doom creator and protagonist of the autobiographical comic book series American Splendor. You can join the conversation tonight. What's closer, more relevant to your life? I don't know, the go-getters on The Apprentice or the downtrodden file clerks in American Splendor? And is America's splendor as dog-eared and disappointing as Harvey Pekar paints it? Here in the 2003 movie version of American Splendor, Pekar, played by Paul Giamatti, shows his friend R. Crumb a storyline with stick figures about his life in Cleveland. It's Pekar's first go at writing for comics.
I tried writing some stuff about real life, you know, stuff that the everyman's got to deal with.
These are all about you?
Yeah.
You turn yourself into a comic hero.
Well, sort of, yeah, but, you know, there's no idealized shit. You know, there's no phony bull. This is the real thing, man. You know, ordinary life is pretty complex stuff.
Paul Giamatti playing Harvey Pekar in 2003's American Splendor. The movie Harvey Pekar is with us tonight from Cleveland. Harvey Pekar, Washington Post writes about you. They say a dismal little man from Cleveland who represents the spirit of reality unvarnished by romance, a hope carved small and bleak of eternal anger and furious resentment. Is that you? Is that a role you play? Which one?
Well, if I deny it, you know, I mean, people won't believe me anyway. Let them listen to me on this show and maybe start to make up their mind, you know. If I'm such a gloom and doom guy, and if I'm such a drag, you know?
Well,
you know, I mean, you know, obviously I think, you know, I'm not quite the curmudgeon that that people say I am. And even if I am, you know, I mean, there's worse things than being a curmudgeon. I never murdered anybody, you know?
Being so, a curmudgeon, I mean, is your meal ticket.
It's my meal. I didn't set out to—I complain a lot, yeah. I do that. There's a lot of self-pity in me and stuff, you know. I've had some hard times, but I haven't handled them very gracefully, you know. I've screamed and wailed and cried about them. But that's the way I am, you know. So, I mean, I don't want to idealize myself, so I portray myself maybe close to at my worst. Sometimes, because I want people to, you know, see themselves in me and identify with the things that I do and the things that I feel. I think that's a, you know, major part of what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, here, you know, I'm living this life and, you know, I'm going through these things and you may be going through them too. And, you know, I hope you take some comfort in the fact that that you're not alone in going through these things. And after all, misery loves company, you know?
Yeah, we hear it. And these are certainly, I don't know, comic books or graphic novels. These are not superheroes or sunny frames, but they can really get under your skin. You say you hope that people will find themselves or their own experience in the comics that you put together. Who's your core audience? How much of America do you think is out there as miserable and frustrated and gnashing their teeth as the Harvey Pekar presented in American Splendor?
Oh, well, you know, I don't think most people are as depressed and compulsive as I am. But I think they have those characteristics in them. And hopefully reading my work, you know, they can identify with them. It's interesting you say about my core audience. My books have always gotten nice critical comments, but they haven't sold very well at all. And they've been mainly aimed at comic book fans. In the last few years, when I was writing for a company in Oregon, I was paid as little as $17 a page for my work. And then, you know, when the movie came out, they put out a companion volume of some of the early work that I had done with Crumb and others back in the, you know, 70s and 80s. And amazingly, it sold. It must be up to about 45,000 copies now, maybe more, you know.
So it's alternate around. Are you now shopping on Rodeo Drive and wearing sequins?
Thanks to my wife, I'm spending more money than I ever spent in my life. And I hope that it keeps on coming in, you know? That's all I can say. Nobody's guaranteed it to me, but I hope it keeps coming. I hope the people keep buying the stuff. Because if they don't, I might have to work for McDonald's or something.
I got to say, it's dark, but it does get under your skin. Here's a little bit from the movie American Splendor that gives a flavor for the comics. In this scene, Harvey Pekar, played by Paul Giamatti, ends up in line at the supermarket behind an elderly woman who presents a cashier a handful of coupons, and he's calculating which line at the supermarket to get in. It's making him miserable, and of course, well, you know which one he picks.
These glasses are 6 for $2 because I couldn't carry 12. But I wanted 12. So today I'm buying 6 more. But you should only charge me $1.50 for them. It's all right. You can ask the manager.
Frank, I need a price check.
Man, old Jewish ladies will argue forever with a cashier about anything.
These glasses.
You get behind them in line, and you're going to wait forever, man.
Because I couldn't carry 12. So today.
I mean, I'm a Yid myself, and women in my family are like that, but I never got used to it. I mean, I may be cheap, but I got limits, man.
Let me explain one more time. These glasses are 6 for $2.
These glasses are 6 for $2. Harvey Pekar, Paul Giamatti's got you down there, but he says, as you would say, women in my family are like that. Women in your family, as you describe them, also pretty gloomy, kind of a depressing view of the world. I mean, where did you get this? This is supposed to be the big land of opportunity. So what set you up, and not you alone, but what set you up for this dark view?
Well, I'll tell you what. Most of my family wasn't born in this country. They were born in Poland. And actually, I was born in 1939. My father had only been over here about 5 years. So they came over as teenagers and adults. So they had a pretty gloomy view of life in Poland. They didn't get treated too well over there. So I think that maybe that has something to do with it, you know. I mean, I don't want to put everything on my family, you know what I mean. I'll take responsibility for some of it.
You watch, like the rest of us do, I assume, some of the kind of parade of American life as presented on American television, in the commercials where everything's green and perfect, in the shows where everybody's glossy and shiny and smiling. And then I look at your stuff, and it's all much darker. And in the movie, we see the very grungy streets of Cleveland. What's your sense of the American reality or realities or illusions we see in mainstream media versus the way you see America?
Well, I mean, obviously, I don't see America as Leave It to Beaver, you know, with those kind of sitcoms that they used to have. I've always had a lot to do with working class people and flunky jobs and things like that. And, a lot of, you know, what I've gone through hasn't been exactly inspiring, but I think I've had a sense of humor about it, and, it hasn't killed me or anything like that. So, you know, I just try to keep on going on, that's all. Got to do it.
Why did you work as a file clerk at the VA hospital for 30 years?
Because I couldn't. I mean, I wasn't qualified to do anything else. And another hang-up I had was every time I'd find something that I could do fairly well and maybe had a future at, I would get so worried about it, you know, about, you know, doing well at it, that I quit it, you know, because I couldn't stand the tension of waiting to see how I would do. So I quit all kinds of things, from sports to college to different jobs. Even when I was working as a mailman, and I quit that because I was afraid I wouldn't tie the bundles of letters up securely enough, and that, you know, when they went to deliver them out on the route, you know, they'd fall apart, you know, and I'd get called on a carpet for it. I mean, I used to have like nightmares about stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, I'm a pretty depressed guy, you know.
we hear it. You've worked with so many illustrators in putting American Splendor together over the years. You said Art Crumb, of course, Kevin Brown and Greg Budget and Sean Carroll, and I mean, just Val Merrick. We've got one of those illustrators joining us tonight from Cleveland.
Great.
A pal of yours, Gary Dumm. He and his wife Laura have maybe been your most frequent associates in illustrating the comics that you write. Gary Dumm, are you there?
Indeed I am, Tom.
It's great to have you. You've been working with Harvey Pekar since the 70s. We appreciate your joining us tonight. What's it like to work with this famously down-and-out, gloomy, glum, curmudgeon Harvey Pekar?
Well, maybe the aspect that I bring to it is that, for me, mainly the glass is half full rather than half empty. And I see in Harvey, though, a sort of a brutal honesty that is really hard to find in a lot of purely prose autobiography, let alone almost anything in comics.
Give us an example. What kind of thing will Harvey lay out there that others don't?
Well, I like to portray it in generalities as, from something.
We got to watch your language there. Sorry. So, when he acts well, it's in the story. When he doesn't act well, it's in the story. It's all there.
It's almost, and that was the aspect of the American Splendor movie that supported American Splendor, in that the documentary bag that Bob and Sherry, the directors, came out of, actually enhanced the honesty that Harvey, I feel, has in the almost reportorial quality at times that he brings to American Splendor. And as such, he garnered early on from me a lot of respect for that being in there. Of course, as a kid, I read all kinds of superhero stuff and escapist literature. But at the time that I met Harvey, I guess I was ready to do something that was a bit different. And certainly at that time, considering the bag that I'd come out of, superhero, science fiction, things like that, fantasy, it was quite different for me. But it was an additional challenge because of that.
I'm sure it was. Harvey Pekar, what do you deliver to the illustrators like Gary Dumm and Laura Dumm? What, you give them, obviously, the language of the comic strip, but the stick figures, how explicit is each frame visually presented to them?
Well, I put in the dialogue and the captions and the thought balloons, and, you know, I write in the panel, you know, like what's supposed to go in there, and then I'll call up each artist and I'll talk to them, you know, go over the story, you know, try and go over it panel by panel to, you know, give them more information about what I'm looking for. And sometimes, you know, we can use, you know, photographs for reference. That helps a lot. And this, with all this stuff with computers and stuff like that, you can pick up a lot of information and, you know, visual information that's very helpful in doing stories.
And zip it right along to your illustrator. I want to let our callers in here. Martin's calling from Boston. Hi, Martin. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a big fan of the autobiographical comic genre, and I always thought Harvey's work was one of the forefronts there. And I was wondering if he considers himself part of that school of comic book writing or artist. I know he doesn't illustrate his own work, but does he consider himself to be part of that, along with Joe Matt and Chester Brown and that crop of artists.
The autobiographical comic artist.
Yeah, sure I am. And as a matter of fact, you know, a lot of the guys that are in, and maybe even women too, that are in the in this school of autobiographical comics, have said that I've influenced them. I know Joe Matt has, and Chester Brown's done some work after I did it that reminded me of my stuff a lot. Chester does a lot of things, though. He's very interesting. Very interesting cartoonist. So, yeah, sure. I mean, my work's clearly autobiographical. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell things, you know, from my standpoint, because that's what I know the best, me.
Straight on. Martin, thanks for your call. Gary Dumm, I'm looking through the books here, and, of course, there's many different ways that Harvey's presented. I mean, R. Crumb has got him just with waves of sweat coming off. He looks anguished, eyes bulging and all that. Under your hand, he's kind of a studly-looking guy for all this gloomy stuff. I mean, so how do you decide how frazzled or together to present Harvey Pekar?
That's a interesting question, because there are some times when I feel the approach to Harvey needs to be slightly more cartoony. There are other times when I absolutely try to be as naturalistic, not realistic, but naturalistic as possible while still doing a cartoon version. And then there are times when, yes, I'll think that going over and taking a few photos of Harvey to make it more realistic is the right approach. It kind of depends upon reading the particular story. That determines which approach that I try to take.
Harvey, where do you put your ego in the way you get illustrated? Are you pushing these guys to make you look like, you know, Mr. Buffman? Or what do you feel when R. Crumb comes in with his crazy, bug-eyed Harvey Pekar?
Well, I think they all work. I mean, you know, they... I got a lot of different characteristics. I mean, even Gary draws me, you know, a couple of different basic ways, depending on the nature of the story. Sometimes he is more cartoony than others. And, you know, I'm not trying to get over as a, you know, like a Hollywood leading man in those, you know, in these stories. I mean, it would go against the...
to trust us. We believe you. Yeah. We've seen the book. Harvey Pekar, Gary Dumm, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Harvey Pekar, the famously gloom and doom creator and protagonist of the autobiographical comic book series American Splendor, source of the 2003 movie starring Paul Giamatti. He's out with two new collections of his comic work, American Splendor. Let's see, Best of American Splendor, just out today. A big, fat, really engrossing book of dark side of life in Cleveland. Not always dark, but plenty of gloom there. And the story of his life of intersection with the movie business, American Splendor, Our Movie Year. On the front, you see Harvey and his wife saying, "Hey, Harvey, the actors look better than we do." And, well, that's kind of like it was. Also with us tonight, Gary Dumm, one of the illustrators who puts the visuals to Harvey Pekar's dialogue and thought bubbles for his American Splendor comic book series. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Joe's calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Joe, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
I would like to point out that Harvey Pekar it hasn't been discussed because of his work in this American Splendor, but the most amazing, gifted, visionary, alone person that finds jazz players who've been around for 25 and 30 years and have been rejected because their styles are a little too off the wall or something like that, I being one of them. And around 19, I don't know when it was, but when I was 67 years old, I'm 78 now.
Joe, what's your full name?
Joe Maneri.
Joe Maneri.
One of the greats. How you doing, Joe? God bless you for calling.
I'm just bursting to tell the public of your most amazing understanding of what people call avant-garde jazz musicians. He had discovered me when I, being in the New England Conservatory and playing my kind of jazz, and people didn't want to know from it, playing in jazz circles, people ran from me. Wherever I went, they said, what is he doing?
But Harvey Pekar saw it, lifted it up.
Harvey Pekar not only picked it up, but put his entire energy and must have called prominent jazz musicians, maybe something in the area of 45 to 50 prominent jazz musicians on my behalf.
That's pretty great, and we hear the gratitude coming through tonight. Harvey Pekar, is there something about the view of the world we see in your comics and your perspective as a jazz critic that would lead you to reach out to the avant-garde jazz guys like Joe Maneri?
Well, I think that an art form in a way is as good as its avant-garde. I mean, if the avant-garde dies or isn't heard or something like that, and there's actually sort of a possibility that might happen in jazz now, then the art form becomes a kind of a museum piece. Joe is an amazing, amazing musician. He's been ahead of his time for so long. And I'll tell you, not everybody, like Joe says, people were scared of his playing and stuff like that. But there's a lot of musicians over the years, like George Russell and Cecil Taylor and people like that, Rand Blake, that really thought Joe was great. But Joe was so far ahead of his time that, record companies didn't want to mess with him. They figured people couldn't understand him. Finally, and I heard him in 1996. I was writing for this. I was writing for the Boston Herald. I was writing jazz criticism. Mm. And I just was knocked out by his plan. I thought, God, this guy is fantastic. And I called him up, because, I mean, I wonder, how can this guy be around for so long and not, be on top of the heap?
And you helped lift him right up there. We're glad to connect you two tonight. Joe Maneri, thanks so much for calling in. I want to get to another caller here. There's so many waiting, Harvey Pekar. John's calling from New York City. Right. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Scott Lucas, John Scott Lucas, calling from New York City. And I am an assistant editor at DC Vertigo, which is putting out Harvey Pekar's next book, The Quitter.
That's part of DC Comics, right, The Quitter coming up. So you've got an interest in this book. What do you make of it?
I think it's something of a, in my opinion, a divergence from stuff that Harvey's done before. It's a story about his life.
That's the same.
Well, yes, except it's a narrative about his youth as opposed to something being much more in the present tense. And it's called The Quitter because it's about many of the things that Harvey has attempted and failed at. But I think what's different about it is that a lot of people are going to see this book and see Harvey as not somebody who's a loser, but as a guy who has had a lot of failures and not let it stop him. And every time,
Coming back. John, thanks for your call. Harvey, what about it? Your next one is called The Quitter. And
right.
your editor says, shows that you're not a loser. The Quitter sounds like a loser. What's the story?
Well, I don't know. It's up to everybody else to determine whether I'm a loser or not. I mean, I just go out and I do my work. I try and survive. I quit a lot of things because I couldn't stand doing them because they made me too shook up and nervous and stuff. But then I tried to find other things. I just kept on going. And I mean, what are you going to do? If you're going to be alive, you got to do something. So I just kept my arms and legs moving,
And I have to say, reading through your books, there is a lot of curmudgeonly stuff in there. But through it, there comes that kind of guy who just won't quit behind it. and a kind of humanity along with that.
You know, I think that in terms of that, Tom,
Gary Dumb, yeah,
a sort of takeoff on a Japanese quotation, which goes along the lines of "fall down 9 times, get up 10 times."
Yeah, no kidding. You know, Harvey Pekar, we don't have a lot of time left, but I want to ask you one thing. You did kind of quit was you quit appearing on David Letterman's show between 86 and 94. You were on there a lot, and then it was over. Why'd you walk away from that?
Well, I didn't walk away from it. He just didn't want me on anymore. I mean, when he asked me to come on the show, I'd come on the show. I guess I just used to upset him too much or something. And then in the end, when he moved over to CBS, I guess he probably figured his fans didn't get me. I don't know.
Did you feel like a performing animal for David Letterman sometimes? I mean, he sort of provoked your supreme Harvey Pekar caricature.
Well, I started out doing that, but I got sick of it. You know, I mean, I figured he wanted me to caricature myself, and I did for the first couple of shows. I figured it'd just be, you know, like I'd be on there once, or, you know, I didn't even think I'd be on there twice, and I just clown around and, you know, and hopefully, well, my magazine sales would go up. But Letterman kept on calling me back, but he didn't want to change anything. He just wanted to, you know, me to be act the same way, and I got tired of it. You know, I don't mind being funny or trying to be funny, but, you know, not the same way all the time. That's what I told him, and he wouldn't go along with me. Meantime, my sales weren't going up. Being on the show wasn't really helping me very much. So I just decided that I would just do whatever I felt like doing and say whatever I felt like doing on the show because I had nothing to lose.
And that was the end of that.
Well, he didn't like it too much.
You know, you're on the other side of movie stardom in a way now. You've got these much bigger sales you were talking about. So is life becoming splendid for you, Harvey Pekar, or eternally not?
Well, I mean, I got more money. That's more splendid than less splendid. I hope I keep on making that money. That's all I can say, you know, that everybody would say that. You know, it's opened up some new jobs for me. Now we'll just have to see what happens. If I can hold on to the jobs, if my stuff sells, or, you know, if not, you know, then I'm going to have to try and figure out some other kind of way to supplement my income, because I sure am not getting enough to support my wife and kid, you know, from my government pension.
Well, so. There it is. Gary Dumb, I'm sure you'll be there waiting for more dialogue from the pen of Harvey Pekar.
Stuff almost literally as we speak.
I'm sure you are.
There
Thanks
you
so
go.
Much for being with us tonight.
Absolutely.
And Harvey Pekar in Cleveland, creator of the autobiographical comic American Splendor, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been wonderful. Thank you very much.
In a moment, the trial of colorful HealthSouth CEO Richard Scrushy begins. This is On Point. Today in Alabama, the trial of Richard Scrushy, the former high-flying CEO of HealthSouth Medical Clinics, got underway. In a Birmingham courtroom, lawyers for both sides delivered their opening arguments. Scrushy is accused of orchestrating a $2.7 billion accounting fraud. He could face 450 years in prison and up to $30 million in fines. But the trial isn't just drawing attention because of those numbers. Scrushy is a colorful character, a famously big spender, a prolific local philanthropist, and now a budding televangelist. His case comes during a defining year in the government's fight against corporate fraud. CEOs of WorldCom and Enron are also lining up for trial in 2005. Joining me now from Birmingham, Alabama, is Dan Morse, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who's covering the trial. Dan, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
So what came out in the opening arguments today? Any surprises in the courtroom?
Not really, although Richard Scrushy's attorneys were very strong in saying that, you know, you're not going to see any memos in this, talking to the jurors, you're not going to see any memos, any emails, any notes with Richard Scrushy's fingerprints on it. It's the blame it on the CFO defense.
And not just the CFO, but a lot of CFOs.
Yeah, five of them who are lined up to testify against him. So this will be a long and interesting trial.
Dan, what's the government charging here? Give us a sense of the charges and the picture they're painting behind them.
They're throwing a lot at Mr. Scrushy, conspiracy, securities fraud, violation of the new Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which means, according to the government, he signed financial statements that were wrong. There's a lot of charges, more than 40 of them. Some observers say that the government may be trying to do too much, trying to throw so much out there that it could get confusing by the end of things.
And we're reading that Scrushy's reputation and his background in Birmingham may affect the jury selection, the jury, the way they look at him.
Well, yeah, there's been, he's done a number of things over the last year or two where his critics say, that was an attempt to reach jurors.
In particular,
African-American jurors. He has become involved in a church, the Guiding Light Church, with a strong African-American membership, and he's got this show on every morning. I try to catch it when I'm in Birmingham. Comes on at 6 a.m. Where he's on there, and his wife they got their Bibles out, and it's sort of a Bible study on a local cable TV station. I think he's sincere in his faith. Other people might debate that, but. There's a lot of views on this man, and some people take it as far as say, no, this is just a ploy to reach out to potential jurors out there.
The juror selection, of course, has been wrapped up at this point. Did his defending lawyers seem to get the kind of jury they wanted?
There are a number of African Americans on there. We think there may be as many. As six, it's tough to say because what you're looking at is a panel of 18. So you've got six alternates there, and you don't really know who the 12 are. They've kept their names sort of secret from us. That's a real superficial way to look because we really don't know too much else about the jurors. So.
The trial's going to go on for a while, for several months. In the meantime, he's not exactly hurting. He's got something like $10 million for living expenses on top of $30 million for attorneys and forensic accountants, $12,000 a month the court allowed him for household help.
Yes. Well, they really went after and tried to freeze all that stuff after this case broke, and the government lost that. And so he's been, his big house is where he launches his defense out of. He's got a big office back there and a guest house, and that's where he and his lawyers are working. He's a very active defendant.
And not suffering on the way to justice or whatever comes. Dan Morse, we're out of time, but thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Sure.
The Richard Scrushy story. Dan Morse is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Birmingham. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.